Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Will Kelleher and you're listening to our special series examining just what it takes to win the Rugby World Cup in the company of those who have been there and done it. We'll take you from 1987 to 2019 through the eyes of great world champions ahead of the 10th World Cup in France this autumn. We'll hear their memories and stories, anecdotes and insights, all with the goal of answering one simple but devilish question. How do you win the World Cup? So join us on a rugby journey to whet your appetite for France with Legends of the Game. This time on How to Win the World Cup, it's time to celebrate England's happy and glorious triumph in 2003. 20 years ago, Beyoncé is crazy in love with Finding Nemo in cinemas as Roman Abramovich buys Chelsea and Concorde takes its final flight. England clinch a Six Nations Grand Slam by crushing Ireland in Dublin, then puff their chests out down south, beating New Zealand in Wellington and Australia in Melbourne to confirm their status as the world's number one rugby team under Clive Woodward. Come the World Cup in Australia, they're favoured, maybe even expected to win, and, well, you know the story. From Jason Robinson whizzing away to Jono belting blokes to Johnny dropping the goal in extra time against the Wallabies, England are World Cup winners for the first time. Now, this episode is going to be a little different as we have two guests who've written a book together about it all 20 years on. First, in the stands for the Times was our man Owen Slott, and of course, on the field for it all was number 8 Lawrence Dallaglio. So, from The Times and The Sunday Times, this is a Ruck special, How to Win the World Cup with Lawrence Dallaglio and Owen Slott. So, Lawrence, great to have you back on The Ruck. You and Slotty, the prodigal sons of The Ruck, returning. we've got to start with Lawrence first, clearly. So, it's a question we're asking everyone on the series. Lawrence Dallaglio, how do you win the World Cup? Is it as easy as that?
With great difficulty, I mean, first of all, it's great to be home again. I feel like it feels like a World Cup ago that I was on the pod. But no, with great difficulty, took us a long time to win it. And on the basis that England haven't won one since, I think it shows how difficult it is to win a World Cup
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, we'll try and find a sort of definitive answer of sorts by the end of our chat, but let's explain, let's add some context to why you're both here. We might have had you on because we're all friends, but Slotty, you and Lawrence have written a book about 2003. It's called Boys of Winter, out in all good bookshops and all that. There's your plug. So tell us about the book, the format of it, and the story you're trying to tell 20 years on.
Yeah, thanks, Will. It's been a really interesting, fun, and time-exhaustive journey that Lawrence and I did. So I was in the Press Tribune for the 2003 World Cup final for the whole of the World Cup. So I sat there and wrote about it and thought I had one of the best seats in the house. And now 20 years on, I've had an even better viewpoint of it, if you like, because Lawrence and I effectively done a road trip and we've gone back round the squad of 2003 plus their coaches, gone and visited most of them. And we've been retelling the story, but the way people look at what happened 20 years ago with the benefit of 20 years hindsight shed so much new light on what we thought we knew, what people said at the time, what they were, how they felt at the time. People felt things at the time that they didn't feel free to express. They probably didn't even know if that's actually what was, you know, what was going through their minds. And then there's been a lot of what happened to them since and what happens to you when you're a World Cup winner and what happens in your next life. So it's been a long road trip, as we've been calling it, because most of it was done on the road, and it really fascinating. And hopefully the book will go down and exemplify all that.
So Lawrence, obviously when you're part of a team like that, you tend to get to know everyone pretty well, but what were the bits that on this road trip that you've uncovered that you thought, God, I wish I'd known that at the time, or I have no idea that's how you felt?
Well, I mean, first of all, as Owen said, it's the first part of the book talks about the incredible 9 weeks that we had in Australia, culminating in that night in Sydney. And when you leave that dressing room after a World Cup final, it'd be interesting to see what the other guys who you have on the podcast say, but your world is never the same again, you know. And so the second part of the book interrogates with far more curiosity the two really interesting questions, which is, do you think it was a good thing that we won the World Cup? And how has it changed your life? For those who don't know, that was Martin Johnson's last ever game of rugby for England, along with quite a few of our colleagues. Johnny Wilkinson, the winner of the World Cup with his drop goal, didn't actually play for England for another 3.5 years after that final. Some of us were playing again the following week, and I was delighted to be playing again the following week after I'd sobered up, obviously. But I guess we haven't got together as a group. We got together once in 20 years since that famous night in Sydney, and we will get together again in November. And that's no bad thing, but it was just fascinating, really, to go round, to see everyone, to speak to everyone. You know, Martin Johnson obviously has been through an awful lot in that time. Amazing player, amazing captain. You know, was England coach for a while, probably quite successfully when you look back at previous England coaches in recent years. And, you know, you could hardly get a word out of him when he played, but, you know, you couldn't really shut him up. And just as well, because he has a lot to offer the game. I thought he was fascinating with his insights and his memory of detail, you know, his ability to recount things, little details that happened in the build-up to some of those games. I hadn't realised that when Mike Tindall was not selected for the semi-final, he, you know, a fit of rage, went out in Sydney and met his now wife, Zara Phillips. So okay. You know, there you go. A lot of other people have claimed to matchmate those two, but we can't give all the credit to Clive Woodward for dropping him. There were some fascinating insights into, you know, more the mental side of the game, some of the self-doubt that a lot of the players, I'm sure Owen would concur, some of the private sort of self-doubt and sort of self-belief maybe that certain players had to sort of go through in order to get themselves into the right place to play the game.
I was going to ask this at the end, but I don't know. It's a funny old thing, isn't it? Winning a World Cup, as you said, with the, are we happy that we won it? Of course we are, but did it improve your life? And is there some tinge of sadness maybe within all the joy 20 years on that, one, I don't know, you never played again, there's sadness around Steve Thompson and what's happened to him since with his dementia diagnosis, there's the fact that the legacy was never really built on, England have not repeated it, amid all the joy and all the memories that people have got of it around England and beyond, do you look back and you just say, it's not maybe as special as it could have been?
Well, there's two parts to that question, isn't there? The first part is, I've lost count the number of people that said to me, shake your hand in the street and just say, thank you for giving us the greatest morning of our lives. You know, I mean, in terms of sporting lives, I'm assuming, after their marriage and their birth of their children, people that came up to you and said, I was there, I was in the stadium. And it is an I was there moment. And if you look at England are the only nation in the world to have won a football, cricket and rugby World Cup. But all three have gone to extra time. So there is this kind of script that English teams like to write around making it as dramatic as possible. And you know, I'm one of these patriotic people that don't dine out on the fact that England haven't won a World Cup in 20 years. I would be delighted, having been in a World Cup final the following World Cup and seen a group of players, which I was involved in, lose a World Cup final as well as win one. You know, that is the polar opposites of sport. You know, it's love, it's hate, it's win or lose. And the feelings I've had, I'd love to share with other people. So we've been in two finals since then and we haven't managed to close them out. I'd love nothing better. But the legacy of 2003 is a strange one because there's so much intellectual property, so much rugby intelligence within that group. And yet only two or three of them really are involved in what I call frontline rugby coaching now, which is a great shame, really.
Slotty, you write about loads of different sports. Is that, I don't know, a constant theme across champions that it's maybe not as glorious as we all think?
One of the really interesting things about going through the whole squad again is how happily it sits with them, because by definition, these are, you know, not just high performers, but weirdly high performers. These are the highest of the high, and many of them who can't let that go. Not surprising, it's in their DNA. So they kind of want to go out and do it again, if that's in coaching or another walk of life. I mean, Josh Lucy is the one that sort of comes to mind. He was in the army. He's a trained lawyer. He's worked in finance. He's won a World Cup, and now he's in the Far East, sort of running private equity houses. And this eternal drive. So he feels very comfortable with what he's done. Some of them have tried to come to terms with the fact that that was the peak of that was their Everest, and that their lives will never find that high again. I mean, we had this fascinating chat with Trevor Woodman, who was literally talking his way through that sort of recognition that that was the high, and he got injured quite quickly after the World Cup. And he said so many times, I only got 22 caps, and only was the word that he would use all the time. And Lawrence would go, mate, you won the World Cup. But he said, yeah, but it wasn't quite enough. I only got 22. I wanted more. So he wanted to stay up on that high again or find an equivalent. And then some people you would find were just so blissfully at ease with what they'd done, and I would say that the player most comfortable with themselves, you know, in the time we met him, was Martin Johnson, who you would say was the sort of the ultimate driving force. But he just comes over so relaxed and happy with where he is. He's not, you know, he's been the England coach, so he has had a go at reaching the pinnacle again. But now he's just made he's so at peace with himself, and he goes, I'm just really happy with life the way it is. I've had that experience and I don't need to go there again.
Yeah. What about the guys around the sides of the team? Because at all World Cups, there's not just the management of the people actually playing and winning it, but it's the people on the fringes, isn't it? We were talking before we recorded, and the different stories of those guys who maybe didn't quite feel part of it as well, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, there's inevitably, you know, I think we were very quick to endorse that when it underpinned our culture, really, that none of us is as good as all of us, really. And the success of the frontline players was purely not just down to themselves and their own drive, but down to the competition that existed within the group. You know, that drove us all the way over the line to the final. I mean, I reflect back and through, not deliberately, but I ended up with this rather nicely sounding statistic that I played every minute of every game in a World Cup, which I'm not sure any player would do these days because of the fact that you have different roles for substitutions. But on one extreme, I played in every minute. But as you say, there were players that maybe played one game, two games, maybe a piece in every game. Like Julian White, for instance, was a prop who played over 51 times for England, yet he wanted to be Trevor Woodman. He'd rather play 20 times than played in the World Cup. Or he'd have probably played 50 times and wanted more than just two games in a World Cup. Whereas Trevor Woodman played 22 times, but actually wanted to be Julian White. Yeah. So it's quite interesting, isn't it, to see where people sit within the hierarchy. Some were happy to be there. Some were wanted more and felt that their quality as players deserved more game time. And there were others that were lucky enough to be out there. So it's a really interesting you know, question you ask.
Well, this is one of the things that I found really fascinating and really engaging to be inside of. So just for instance, our conversation with Kieran Bracken, who you just feel was so integral to that team and that victory, but he didn't get on for a minute of the World Cup final. And when you talk to him about it seriously, he says, 20 years on, he still regrets that. 20 years on, he still doesn't really feel like a World Cup winner. And Lawrence, it's so much in Lawrence's personality that he wants everyone, you know, we're all in this together. Come on, we're all in this. And Lawrence, I think it's fair to say you're pretty surprised by that because you yeah. felt that he was such a big player. He had a huge role in the South Africa game. You don't think that he was on the sideline at all. And Lawrence would say, come on, Kieran, you know, you were integral. You were in that South Africa game that was arguably the most important game of the lot. Of course you're a World Cup winner. And Kieran going, Lawrence, you just know what it's like. I'm competitive like you. I wasn't in it.
Well, I mean, I think scrum halves are a Jekyll and Hyde anyway, because one minute they're in favour and they're in the team, and then the next minute they're dropped. I mean, Matt Dawson and Kieran Bracken probably have as many, I don't know actually, but they probably have as many England caps as each other. Because,
similar, yeah.
You know, one week Kieran was flavour of the month, and then the next week Matt Dawson would be. And maybe Kieran, you know, when the music stopped, you know, Matt Dawson was in possession of the shirt. And, you know, I just know if I asked every single member of the squad, toughest game we had in that World Cup was that South Africa game. The pressure on us going into that pool match, et cetera, et cetera. And Matt Dawson didn't play. I think he got injured the week of the game, and Kieran did. He was playing against the late and great Joost van der Vestes, and he was undoubtedly the man of the match that day. So, yes, he didn't play in the final, and that is, you know, personally for him, you know, not a nice feeling because you feel you're good enough, but we wouldn't have even got to a final without him.
Well, let's get into the matches in a second, but let's lay a bit of context, I suppose, to the build-up. So 99 doesn't go to plan. Yanni De Beers dropped goals. That's always the story that's told, is that game started formulating this build-the-score, drop-goal plan. And then you've also got the 0-3 Grand Slam finally getting that done. When, for you, Lawrence, did it start building through and saying, like, right, it's not just about competing at this World Cup, it's about winning it?
Well, I mean, listen, we try not to go delve into it too much in the book, but certainly 97, when Clive Woodward was appointed, was a turning point in English rugby, because the first thing he said was, where the New Zealand stay when they come to England? And someone said Penny Hill Park, and they said, not anymore. You know, his first act was to throw them out the best hotel in the country. So I knew he was quite mischievous even back then. But, you know, he was the one, Clive Woodward, and we interviewed him. In the book, we got far more out of his wife than we did out of him, which is quite interesting. You know, what's it like to be with a coach the week of a World Cup final, for instance? But he set the vision of wanting England to win a World Cup. You know, he wanted us all to be household names. We left that room after the first meeting with a very clear picture in our minds about winning the World Cup. What we didn't know was that it would be the World Cup in 6 years from that day rather than 2 years. And I think when Clive was reappointed, that was the point where we really started to build. We knew that we were a good enough team, but we had a lot more hard work ahead of us. And it was a long journey. But I think the turning point, and I probably said it a lot, is around 2000, when we went over to South Africa and we lost the first test match because the TMO lived around the corner. literally, it was the first time in world rugby had appointed a TMO. Unfortunately, they didn't realise or think that it would be good to make them independent. So this guy lived 45 minutes from the stadium. There was absolutely no way he was going to award the try. And then we went on to win the second test in Bloemfontein. And I think for us to have beaten the South Africa in South Africa back then was a big deal. And that to me was the start of our journey of belief into realizing that actually we were capable and good enough to win a World Cup.
I find that interesting because in the conversation we've been having with people who've played the earlier World Cups, it's all a bit seat of the pants and it's all a bit late. And the later ones, it's all about this 4 year cycle. And some of that narrative helps coaches, doesn't it? Because it keeps them in a job saying, oh no, it'll all be fine in 2 years or whatever. But was it a cycle thing for you guys?
Yeah, we had the ingredients. I mean, look, if you cast your mind back to 1997, when the British and Irish Lions toured South Africa, England provided 18 players on that tour. I think it was 18 out of 34 or 18 out of 35. We came back having defeated the then world champions in their own backyard and emulated the greats of 74. So I was 24 years old. Martin Johnson wouldn't have been a lot older. There was a lot of very good players on that tour. Richard Hill, Neil Back. You know, the list goes on and on. Paul Grayson, Matt Dawson, you know, so you could almost go back to 97 and say, if you come back from South Africa, having just beaten the world champions and Alliance Tour, surely anything and everything is believable and possible after that. So I think that was quite an interesting moment in everyone's lives. A lot of fun as well, by the way. and that kind of pointed us towards the World Cup and thought, well, if we can do that, the All Blacks had only done it in 96, I think. So to do that in South Africa allowed us to believe that we could win a World Cup.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Yeah, I suppose for everyone else on the outside of the squad, the moment that maybe hit people between the eyes was when England went down and beat New Zealand in Wellington and beat Australia in Melbourne. Was that for you as a journalist, Lottie, when you started going, this is serious, the expectation's coming?
That was real confirmation of the quality of the team. When that tour was announced, it was considered quite controversial. Can you imagine the England team now doing that, going to New Zealand and then Australia just before the World Cup? You kind of really put your reputation on the line, and you could come back feeling pretty insecure about your chances. But this team came back all the better. You know, famously they beat the All Blacks with 13 players left on the pitch at the end of the game. Even that, Will, was interesting, because when you hear players talk about that, so Neil Back was the first player to be yellow carded towards the end of that, and when he's talking about that, he's given the yellow card, and he says 20 years on, he says, I thought I was going to get into trouble for being the one who let the team down. You know, like as if he was the boy who'd sort of been sent out of class or something. And then he says, by the time he got to his seat, he looked up and he realised I wasn't going to be in trouble at all because someone else had been yellow carded, and that was Lawrence.
Just very clear that the yellow card was for saving a try. You know, the reality is that there are those that are gratuitous and stupid, and there are those that Justin Marshall, thankfully, tore his hamstring on the 22. And as he got brought down 5 yards from the line, I just killed the ball completely necessarily. Otherwise, there'd have been quite a few ahead. But it was an amazing win. But not only that, which obviously got all the headlines, but the rest of our squad had gone down to New Plymouth and beaten the New Zealand Maoris in the home of New Zealand rugby, you know, on the few days preceding that. So I think the strength in depth that we had within our group was really underpinned. And of course, the usual rubbish came out in the New Zealand Herald the next day. And then the mind games with Eddie Jones started the following week. And, you know, you can't play any rugby. We didn't play very well in New Zealand, but we did enough to win the game. And then we obviously outscored Australia 3-1 in Melbourne. So it was a risk, no doubt about it. But we wanted to keep our run against the Northern Hemisphere, against the Southern Hemisphere going. I'd never played a test match for England in New Zealand. I've only played one. I only played one up to that point. So I think it was an opportunity for us all to go and do something that we'd never done before.
Yeah. So when you actually arrived in Australia for the World Cup, Lawrence, was the expectation among yourselves was to win the tournament, but were you getting that from the Australians that they sort of saw you as a threat, or the other countries, and they were trying to start the slagging matches early?
Well, of course they saw us as a threat. We'd beaten them 6 times in the lead up to the World Cup, so we were a very real threat and the number one side in the world. We arrived in Perth, actually, and for anyone who's been to Perth, it's almost like a little oasis away from the rest of Australia, in the sense that, you know, you didn't really know that there was a World Cup going on at the time. We checked into the same hotel that we'd been in about 2 or 3 months before that, and we kind of very much felt at home. And it took a long time for the World Cup to really get going, until the game against South Africa, when we knew we were at the tournament for sure.
So when did it start building and you thought, right, this is getting really serious? Was it that South Africa one was the one? And because you had Samoa and Uruguay after that, and then the banana skin, I suppose, with Wales.
Well, the tough game was the South African game. It was always going to be, you know, if everyone recalls the autumn before the World Cup, we played New Zealand, South Africa, and Australia, New Zealand, Australia, and South Africa in consecutive autumn internationals, and we'd beaten South Africa by 50 points. And, you know, Corne Kruger sort of trooped off the field and they said, see you in Perth, you know, and it was meant exactly like that. So they were the usual abrasive South African side, but let's not forget they were young and they went on to win the World Cup in 2007. That was always going to be a tough game for us.
Well, that South Africa game, Martin Johnson talking about that was interesting. So Jono's not one given to hyperbole, really, is he, as we well know. But he said that was the most pressurized game he ever experienced in his life going into that. And he did things that he'd never done before. Like he went down to the stadium the night before to visualize what was coming. He talked about his role in covering the space on the edge of the ruck and the letting Yusuf Vastevezen go past him was the biggest fear in his life. You know, all these things from Jono, who's such a level-headed guy. It was really brought at home just how huge that game was.
Yeah, I would agree. There was a lot of pressure going into that, as there is whenever you're the number one side. I think the biggest learning I had from the 2003 World Cup is that when you go into a World Cup and everyone is expecting you to win it, and you are the number one side and have been for quite some time, give or take the odd defeat that we had, it does create a different pressure on you, as it will for Ireland this time around. It's not an easy hat to wear. I mean, maybe it is for the All Blacks or the South Africans because they've done it for quite some time, but it definitely creates a different type of pressure.
Slotty, you mentioned Johnny there, and you were his ghostwriter, writing his column for that World Cup, and you've written a book with him, and obviously he was the golden boy for everyone else and the fans, and marry me, Johnny signs everywhere. But already at that point, did you get the sense that he was a different character and this wasn't your sort of usual sporting person to work with?
Yeah, we knew that Johnny was pretty extreme but before we got there. One of the interesting things about going around and talking to everyone is they kind of confirm what people maybe had thought at the time, that I'd thought at the time but just didn't really understand, was that the mental pressure that he was under, the anxiety that he was facing. In today's game, we'd be talking about mental health, and he would be there would be a huge plan laid out to how to look after him, but no one really knew what to do. The players just accepted that we're the best in our position in the country, and that part of that is dealing with extraordinary pressure. Johnny handled it in a way that was different and less comfortable than anyone else by a mile. And with 20 years hindsight, so many of the players say, I wish I'd said this to Johnny, or I wish we'd done this to make it easier for him. They're like parents understanding kids now and going, I realise what it was now, that this was a guy that was really carrying a load that was very hard for him to bear. And that, again, part of the book is, how was rugby 20 years ago? Well, that was one of the ways. It was still very much a man's sport. And I'm using an old cliche when I say that. And you went at it in that way, in that frame of mind.
Yeah, I mean, you have to remember that 2003, the game of rugby was only 8 years into professionalism. And I would say, took a long time for a lot of people to even realise what professionalism actually meant. When I look back and my squad look back on some of those training sessions that we did, you'd wince now thinking about preparing for a game like that. I mean, it's just, it was a very different sport. So Johnny was probably the most intense in terms of his preparations, but there was a lot of players that we spoke to that were holding on to a lot of things that maybe nowadays they'd be much more comfortable talking about.
Well, let's fast forward on the DVD a little bit. We'll gloss over some of the games, but let's talk about the final. And Slotty, one slightly strange element of it, maybe, all around the referee, Andre Watson. Like we know the stories about the scrummaging and Jason Leonard putting his arm around him an extra time, but there was a note sent to Clive Woodward before that final that was all a bit weird and spooky. Is that right?
Yeah, Lawrence actually played quite a significant hand in that, because it was the week of the final. The players' coach was returning from training one afternoon, and they're all getting off the coach, and there's a random punter with a bag that he offers to Clive. Clive has a look at it and him, and sort of thinks, I should probably just go nowhere near this. And so he declines to take it from him. And then about a couple of minutes later in the hotel, Lawrence comes up to Clive and says, Clive, this bloke asked me to give you this bag. and in this bag, there's a whole load of coins and also a note that says, says you want to watch out for the refereeing of this of the final. Well, anyway, Clive's never really got the refereeing of the final out of his head about whether it was right or wrong, and certainly when you look back on the when you look back on that final, you wonder what the hell was going on with the scrum. Why, how a scrum could be as incredibly dominant as England's were for almost the entirety of that game, and yet the penalty count just going way against them. Extraordinary.
Lawrence, what was your memory of that?
Well, my memory was that our relationship with the referee probably wasn't a great one before the game, but it sort of deteriorated thereafter, really. You know, you had the best scrummaging side in the world at the time, England, who just dismantled the much lauded and vaunted French front row in in the semi-final against probably the worst Tier 1 nation front row. And as Owen said, you know, it wasn't really a contest. And for a South African to not allow a scrum contest is a bit harsh, really. And I think he was ably assisted by his assistant referees. I don't think he gave every decision. But look, you know, there's conspiracy theories, as we've just talked about. There's deep-rooted hatred of England, particularly from the Southern Hemisphere. They didn't want England to win the World Cup, particularly in their own backyard. But the reality is that as players, I've watched the World Cup final back with Martin Johnson. Referees are referees. You know, you can argue about whether the decisions are right or wrong, but whatever we know in rugby is that we've got to accept those decisions, and you've got to manage the process and the situation. And certainly what none of us did particularly well, including Martin Johnson, was change the picture for the referee. In fact, we probably got louder with our abuse towards him, and therefore the penalties kept coming. All I can say in conclusion is that the World Cup, thankfully, was won by a player rather than lost by another player. You know, no one would want to be remembered for giving away a penalty that loses a World Cup. Everyone was crowding Andre Watson in the dinner afterwards. And, you know, I just said to him, look, it's a tough game out there. Thankfully, someone won the World Cup, and we won't remember it for the referee. We'll remember it for Johnny Wilkinson's amazing drop goal.
Let's get onto that then. Where were you for it?
Probably out in the censors, actually. You know, but the whole process, as you know, has been well spoken. I mean, we lost in Wembley by a few points to a Wales team because we didn't really know what to do. Mike Capp missed a drop goal in 1999 in the last few minutes of the game, and we lost. And I think the process that we had, I'd hate to give Wales any credit for anything, really, but that they were part of that process for helping us win the World Cup, because that whole drop goal routine was rehearsed and practiced, and the scenario was there. When Elton Flatley levelled the scores, there was very, very clear indications of where we were going. But there's so many different parts to it, weren't there? You know, there was Mike Catt, who didn't start the game but made a great break. You know, there was the extra few yards from Matt Dawson, which were crucial, really, in the ultimate scheme of things. There was the Martin Johnson taking it even further. There was the million-dollar question of whether Andre Watson would have penalised the entire Australian back row for being offside. Thankfully, it didn't come down to that. You know, it just a beautiful moment, really. It was a great moment.
So when Mike Catt then kicks it out 40 seconds or so later, is that when it properly hit you, Lawrence, that you'd finally done it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, listen, there was an innate belief in our squad, not least from the senior players, that we were going to win that World Cup. But inevitably, you've got to get everyone to a final. You've got to get fit. You've got to be there. We'd beaten Australia many, many times. We actually played our worst game of rugby in about 3 years against Australia in that final. They played their best, and that's probably why it was a little bit closer than it should have been. But we were thrilled, and I speak to Owen about this a lot. We talk about it in the book. The best moment, it was a relief, really, is the best feeling. And then when we got back in the changing room, there was just that wonderful feeling of winning and sharing those experiences and that memory that you cherish forever, because I knew that the team would never be the same again after that moment. So it was a great feeling. It's one that lives in the annuals of English sporting history, really.
Where does the memory go a bit? What point do you get a bit fuzzy about the few days afterwards and the celebrations and the jumbo jet back and all that?
We were the world champions at celebrating well before we became the world champions. Let me tell you that now. We were well rehearsed at that. I think being in that dressing room, you know, there were tears. There was, you know, a lot of happiness, a little bit of sadness, because, you know, as we've discovered 20 years later, the minute you leave that dressing room, nothing is ever the same. But we went on the charge for about 3 or 4 days, I think, and then were led on a plane home. So was it a good thing we won? Absolutely. Did it change your life? Inevitably it does, and it will continue to do so.
Slotty, you would have been a journalist trying to chase around England players for reaction and stuff like that. Was that an absolute nightmare in those few days afterwards, trying to get to someone who was sober enough to talk you through it?
They were pretty decent, actually. Yeah. Clive had organised us anyone who's around who can still stand up should be available to talk to the media the next day. And I do remember it was literally halfway through that media session that but a police car arrived, and out got Jason Leonard, Martin Curry, Mike Tindall, Paul Grayson, and Lawrence Dallaglio, I think. None of them had been back to their hotel from the night before. They'd been on the piss in the King's Cross part of Sydney, tipped out onto the pavement thinking maybe it's time to go back to their hotel, and a friendly police car dropped by and said, do you want us to help you out, boys? And they said yes, and then the policeman said, well, you've got to come back to the station first and sign a few bits and pieces for us, and then we'll take you back. So that was a funny moment. The media relations, funnily enough, after winning a World Cup, were quite good. Hopefully we'll experience that again one day.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah.
I mean, the best experience was obviously the Australian media, who publicly apologised for being whatever they were, insecure idiots, and printing some of the garbage that they printed. Really. I mean, nowadays, can you imagine? I was 31 when we won the World Cup. A lot of the forwards were maybe 1 or 2 years older. I mean, Dad's army, really. I mean, we had people like Tindall and Bolshaw and some of these, who were much, much younger. And I think they begrudgingly, gave us the respect that we probably deserved.
So we better sum up and answer the question that we posed at the top. How do you win the World Cup? Is there a formula? How did you guys do it, Lawrence?
By a drop goal in extra time, really. But it would have been a lot easier if it was done and dusted by half time. Let me tell you that now. Yeah. It's such a... I mean, to play the host nation in their own backyard was the dream scenario, really. So that in itself tells you everything you need to know, really. It was a journey. Jason Robinson probably sums it up the best. We all arrived at the same place, the World Cup final, but our journey there was very, very different. And I think that is quite fair to say that, really. It was a long journey, long process, but certainly a worthwhile one.
Absolutely.
Well, I think part of the answer, Will, that we touch on a bit in the book is, as discussed, it was only 8 years into professionalism, and part of the interest in high performance for that World Cup was who had understood and perfected or got the most out of what professionalism offered for the 2003 World Cup. When the game went professional in 95, New Zealand were pretty much a professional team anyway. South Africa were getting there, and England was cozy old amateurism. And in the 8 years, largely the bit driven by Clive, was when they sort of put the boosters on. And some people say, "Oh, any coach should have been able to win with that team." Well, I think we debunk that myth a bit in the book. But amongst the many things that got them there was the way that they approached that whole business of what professionalism allowed them.
Well, look, great memories from both of you, and anyone who wants to relive it all, 20 years on, Boys of Winter, all good bookshops. There's plug number two, guys. Well done. But look, amazing memories, Lawrence, and it's lived with you for the rest of your life, and always will. So thank you for talking us through it, and also thanks to Slotty for helping you write the book too.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you for having us on.
Absolute pleasure.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.